25. "If you notice that they are entering people's homes, Charlie, come to me," I said as we parted, though I must admit I wondered how I could explain it to my parents. "That, however, must take second place. You will be safe with us, I hope. Promise you'll come." She was touched and promised to do so. Thank God she did not need to. She would not have found me at home. For the next day... At 10 o'clock in the morning I received a telegram. "Please come if you can, Frank." I said goodbye to my parents, almost like someone leaving for war, and took the suburban railway out toward the east to see Frank Landau. I was not unhappy to be called on to do something, instead of passively awaiting the turn of events. Frank Landau was my oldest and best friend. We had known each other since we started grammar school in the same class, had raced together in the Rennbund Altpreußen, and later in proper athletics clubs. We had gone to university together, and were now both referendars. We had shared virtually every boyish hobby and enthusiasm. We had read each other our first literary attempts, and had continued this with more serious pieces later. We both vaguely considered ourselves to be authors rather than referendars. Some years we had seen each other every day, and we told each other everything, including about our love affairs, which we discussed in detail without feeling at all indiscreet, rather as one thinks about them when one is alone. In the 17 years we had known each other, we had never seriously quarrelled. That would have been like quarrelling with oneself. As adolescents, we had derived much pleasure from analysing our differences, among which we counted our racial origins the least. They did not separate us. He was the more brilliant of the two of us. He was very handsome, tall, broad-shouldered, but otherwise lightly built. As a young boy, he had been compared to an Apollo. Later, when his nose had become more prominent, his brow higher, and his face more lined, he reminded me of the young King Saul. His life also, though it was very similar to mine, seemed to be laid out on slightly grander lines. His emotions rose higher and sank deeper. Love shook him more than me, and there was more lustre about his adolescence, for which, however, he paid by periods of deep, devouring, desperate despondency, which I was spared. He was currently in the latest of these depressions, and it had lasted dangerously long. This time it had an external cause. A year before, his girlfriend, Hanni, had been unfaithful, a chance affair, thoughtlessly entered, not really serious. It had completely overwhelmed him. That seems a bit ridiculous by the usual 20th-century standards in love affairs, but this had been a great passion, of a character quite out of fashion, and it sometimes seems no longer possible, like in Goethe's Werther or La Nouvelle Héloïse, the kind that produced Heine's Book of Songs or Chopin's Waltzes. It was the sort of passion that cannot bear light-hearted faithlessness, and what I had witnessed, first with him and then when she realized what she had done with her, was almost a complete inner collapse. The aftermath had been depressing, separation, an incomplete and skewed reconciliation, attempts at affairs with other women that had left him ever more unhappy and at sea. The patched-up friendship with Annie was merely a caricature of the past. There was a gradual spiritual dwindling and decline, and things only got more and more hopeless and tangled. It was the kind of story you read in a novel. It is the toll that is exacted for the bliss of great passion. Recently, another girl had appeared on the scene. Her name was Ellen. She was a cool, intelligent young lady, a student, fairly intellectual in her tastes, who had a not unpleasant air of upper-middle-class calm and regularity. The personification of a cultured convalescence and rehabilitation after murderous revolutions, turbulence, and suffering. I had recently been introduced to her, or rather Frank had presented her to me. Afterward, he had asked me, half-jokingly, what I would say if he got engaged to her. Then he would take his assessor examinations, marry, and become a bourgeois. Was she not the perfect wife for that? I had laughed and called the idea a bit hasty. Frank had also laughed, and we had moved on to other matters. So now I was travelling to his home. His father, with whom he lived, was a doctor, and so under boycott. I was curious how things would look there. It looked barbarous, but also rather ordinary. The doors of Jewish shops, which were quite common in the eastern part of Berlin, stood open. SA men stood in front of them with their legs planted apart, obscenities were smeared on the windows, and the shop owners had for the most part made themselves scarce. Bunches of people stood around, half anxious, half gleeful. The whole business seemed awkward and halting, as though they were all expecting something more, but were not quite sure what. It did not give the impression of imminent bloodshed. I arrived at the Landau's flat without difficulties. They were apparently not coming into people's homes yet, I concluded, with relief for my friend Charlie. Frank was not there. Instead, I was received by his father, a large, jovial old man. We had often talked, and he had generously inquired about my literary work, sung the praises of Maupassant, whom he admired above all others, and pressed me with a certain severity to try quantities of spirits, so to speak, testing the fineness of my palate. Today he was offended. Not worried or anxious, just offended. Many Jews still had this attitude at that time, and I hasten to add that I regard that as a very strong point in their favour. In the meantime, the majority have lost the strength for it. They have suffered too many blows. It is the same process that happens, compressed into a few minutes, when an individual in a concentration camp is tied to blocks and flogged to a pulp. The first blow strikes his pride, and his spirit rears up wildly. The 10th and 20th strike only the body, and produce little more than a whimper. In the last 6 years, the German Jewish community has collectively gone through a comparable experience. Old Landau had not yet been beaten to a pulp then. He was offended, and the only thing that startled me was that he considered me an emissary of those who had offended him. "Well, what do you say?" he began, and ignoring my stammered explanation that I considered it just as disgusting, he faced up to me and said, "Do you really think I have invented false horror stories and spread them abroad? Does any one of you believe that?" I was somewhat taken aback to see that he was preparing to plead his cause. "The Jews would have to be a lot more stupid than we are to send horror stories to foreign countries, as though we had not also seen the newspaper reports that all letters may now be opened. Strangely enough, we are still allowed to read the papers. Does anyone really believe this stupid lie, that we are inventing horror stories? And if nobody believes it, then what do they mean by it? Can you tell me that?" "Of course nobody with any sense believes it," I said. "But what does that matter? The fact is that you have fallen into the hands of enemies. We have all fallen into their hands. They have us now, and they can do with us what they will." He stared bitterly at the ashtray in front of him and only half listened. "It's the lies that so outrage me," he said. "The damned, disgusting lies in all this. Why don't they just kill us if that's what they want? As far as I'm concerned, I'm old enough, but they shouldn't spread these dirty lies as well. You tell me why they're doing that." Deep inside, he could clearly not let go of the idea that somehow I was linked to the Nazis and knew their secrets. Mrs. Landau joined us, greeted me with a sad smile, and tried to come to my defense. "Why are you asking Frank's friend these questions?" she said. "He knows as little as we do. He's not a National Socialist." She said National Socialist formally, politely. But her husband continued to shake his head, as though he were trying to shake off everything we said. "Tell me, please, why they are lying," he insisted. "Why do they still lie, when they already have the power to do what they like? I want to know that." "I think you should look at the boy," she said. "He's moaning so." "For God's sake," I said, "is your son ill?" Frank had a younger brother. They were obviously talking about him. "It seems so," said Mrs. Landau. "He was so terribly upset when he was expelled from the university yesterday, and today he's been sick repeatedly and is complaining of stomach pains. It looks a bit like appendicitis, although—and she made an attempt at a smile—although I've never heard of anybody getting appendicitis from being upset." "A lot happens nowadays that nobody has ever heard of," said the old man grimly, and he got up. He went to the door with heavy steps, then turned around once more and said, "You're a good lawyer, aren't you? Can you tell me this? Is my son committing an offence by letting me examine him instead of boycotting me?"